What I was hoping to do was really give a Bhagavad Gita overview, which means going through it quite quickly as is practical. So there'll be less speaking and more reading, and I'd like to, for the smaller chapters, even the first chapter, we can see if we can do it even in one day. And that way we can get just a feel for the flow, and I'll comment a little bit. A feel for the flow of the ideas. And a feel for the flow of ideas means trying to understand in a practical way what Krishna is presenting to Arjuna. So in the first verse, and mostly in the English, also some of the Sanskrit words. The first verse. Dhritarashtra uvacha. Dharma chetre kuru chetre samaveta yayutsava mamaka pandavachaiva kim kurvata sandeya. So Bhagavad Gita is spoken by Krishna to Arjuna within a larger frame of reference of the battle of Kurukshetra. In the first chapter, especially is relevant to the battle of Kurukshetra, and of course the entirety of the Mahabharata, where the Kurus, as we all well know, a distinction is made between the Kurus and the Pandavas, even though the Pandavas are also Kurus, but mostly due to the intrigues of Dhritarashtra, and even more so due to the envy of Duryodhana. And Duryodhana is practically, as Vidur says in the third canto of the Bhagavatam, he's the personification of offense. And offense means, practically speaking, envy of Krishna and envy of everyone else. So Duryodhana was determined to fight and kill the Pandavas, keeping them from being Yudhisthira from being the king, because he wanted to be the king. He was a very envious person, and he was, one would have to say, completely unreasonable. And Krishna himself tried to settle this dispute, and it's quite interesting that we know that Krishna is the unlimitedly powerful Supreme Lord, and he tried to settle the dispute between Duryodhana and the Pandavas. He came as a messenger, and the result was that the all-powerful was unsuccessful. So there's one meaning of this, is that Krishna, even though he's all-powerful, he doesn't interfere with the free will of the living entity, of the souls. We have our free will, and Krishna, despite his being all-powerful, doesn't interfere with that. So this can branch into many, many topics, which we won't go into right now. But so Krishna tried himself to stop it, the battle, because in the battle there was going to be casualties, deaths of literally millions of people. So to understand the frame of reference in which the Bhagavad Gita is spoken, and this will come up when Arjuna suddenly understands what's really going to happen in this battle, that it's going to be a complete devastation. There's a saying that no one wins a war. And the reason is because war means destruction. Everyone, in Kurukshetra, practically speaking, everyone was killed on both sides. So many of them were related through marriage, through blood. So it was a complete destruction of the Kshatriyas. So on one level, Krishna was unsuccessful in convincing Duryodhana, who was so envious. And on another level, Krishna was completely successful, because his overriding mission when he came was Pritranaya Sadunam Vinasya Chataskritam. He was going to annihilate the overburden of the earth, and he gathered them together just like when he was fighting with when Jarasandha earlier had attacked the city of Mathura, how many times? 16 or 17 before he was defeated, and then before he won, and then each time Krishna let him go, and it was very insulting for Jarasandha, but also Krishna was thinking that in this way he's going to attack again, and he's going to gather all the demonic forces, and I'll just kill them, and this makes my job of eliminating the demonic forces of the earth even easier. Why should I have to go out? They'll all come here, inspired by Jarasandha. So Krishna's will always gets done, but of course there are many different levels of his will. So in this verse, as per the Mahabharata, Dhritarashtra, the blind old king, is speaking to Sanjaya, and Sanjaya is describing to him who he had the vision by the blessings of Srila Vyasadeva. He had the ability to, the vision to see what was going on so far away. So Dhritarashtra, who was blind, used the eyes and vision of Sanjaya to hear what was going on in Battle of Kurukshetra. So he said, "O Sanjaya, after my sons and the sons of Pandu assembled in the place of pilgrimage at Kurukshetra, desiring to fight, what did they do?" He was hoping there wouldn't be a compromise due to the influence of the Holy Land, Dharmachetre, Kurukshetra. He didn't want to compromise because he was even though he was the caretaker of the Pandavas, he wanted them dead so that his sons could rule. It sounds so cruel, even opposing the idea of Krishna, the will of Krishna. It sounds so cruel. How could anyone do that? Be willing to kill relatives, be willing to kill millions of people just so they could gain power? How can anyone do that? Well, welcome to the material world, because that's just what goes on here. People simply don't care. This is the power of Krishna's illusory energy. This is the power of ahankar, false ego. It just makes everyone feel that I'm the center, and what I want is the best thing. And it's the only thing, practically speaking, that's important. So as a result of this, and everyone seeing from their own viewpoint, there are so many horrible things that are done in this world, and that viewpoint is influenced by the modes of material nature, especially passion, ignorance, and the most horrendous things are done in them. This is the land of horrendous things. And we think, oh, I would never do something like that, but actually, when the modes of material nature are dominating us, and in the right association means the wrong association, people are capable of anything, practically speaking. Every sin imaginable, everything against even common sense. So anyway, Sanjay replied immediately, "O king," so he's telling what's happening, this is prior to the battle, "after looking over the army arranged in military formation by the sons of Pandu, King Duryodhana went to his teacher and spoke the following words." So Duryodhana's teacher was whom? Dronacharya. He taught him the way of fighting. He also taught the Pandavas. There are so many pastimes connected with this that are woven into this Kurukshetra war. So Duryodhana was an expert diplomat, and he was trying to incite anger in Dronacharya, because Arjuna was on the opposing side, and actually Arjuna was his favorite student, and Arjuna was the superior student. Arjuna was a superior student because when you have a teacher like Dronacharya, who was practically unlimitedly capable, he had so much ability. What type of teacher, what type of a student makes such a teacher obliged him? What type of a student makes the teacher look upon the student as so favorable? Is that the student wants to learn everything, and he's completely dedicated and focused, one-pointed. The eye of the bird, his focus was on the eye of the bird always. It was on military science, and Arjuna did not sleep, he did not think, he did not do anything except for this. And therefore he was the favorite of Drona Charja, and there he was having to fight his favorite student. So Duryodhana, being very expert in Rajniti, diplomacy, he wanted to incite him to anger, because he was going to have to be at his best, because the Pandavas were formidable with Arjuna, Bhima, etc. on their side. So he said, "O my teacher, behold, look at the great army of the sons of Pandu, so expertly arranged by your intelligent disciple, the son of Jupiter." Who is the son of Jupiter? What's his name? Dhrishtadyumna. And Dhrishtadyumna was going to be the death. He knew this. He was going to be the death of Dronacharya. But yet Dronacharya, look at the consciousness of these people. They were so, they had a consciousness that is almost understandable to us contemporary people. The person who was going to kill him, he knew that Dhrishtadyumna was destined to kill him. And this story about that, Draupadi, Dhrishtadyumna, and Draupad, from the Mahabharata. And yet when the same person, Dhrishtadyumna, wanted to learn the military science, and he came to Dronacharya, he was so liberal in the mood of a Brahmin, of giving, so unselfish, basically, he did not hesitate to teach him the very science that was going to be his own death. Now, if you calculate that from terms of what is gained and what is lost, it seems like a foolish thing to do. But when you calculate it from the point of view of the eternality of the soul, and we in this world, we should act with integrity to our duty, regardless of the cost of what the outcome we think is going to be, negative or positive, to do one's duty with great and full integrity. When you calculate it against that standard, which is practically speaking long gone from the world, I don't know when it died, but it died a long time ago, that no one thinks like that. I mean, not no one, but practically speaking, no one. You know, victory, because the motto nowadays is more that no one remembers. All that counts is if you win. And you could rewrite the history, and it doesn't make a difference how you got what you got, but that you got it. That's all that counts. This is the contemporary ethic, which is not at all ethical, obviously, and it leads to a hellish society. So we can see that we residents of Kali Yuga tend to be infected Hare Krishna. We tend to be infected with these qualities. We're surrounded by them. It's not by accident that we're born in Kali Yuga either. Like, we have no tendencies towards irreligion and immorality and unethical behavior. We have no tendencies, but it's everyone else's fault. No, we're born at this time because we want to be born at this time. We have the perfect qualities and the perfect mentality to take a birth in Kali Yuga. But this is what it's like, and it's a hellish time, because everyone only cares. Everyone is selfish, basically. Unsatisfied and selfish. And thinking, well, the reason why I'm unsatisfied is because I'm simply not selfish enough. This is what's going on. I should take care of myself instead of being generous-hearted. And of course, Kali has everyone bewildered. So Duryodhana continues speaking to Dronacharya. After saying that the person who you trained is opposing you, you've trained him to kill you and to kill our army, you have to be ready to really fight. So here in this army are many heroic bowmen. This is not his own army, but the opposite, opposing army. Equal in fighting to Bhima and Arjuna. So Bhima is there, and Bhima had vowed to kill all the sons of Dhritarashtra because of the terrible way they had acted. And Arjuna, the most powerful of bowmen, and so dear to Krishna. Great fighters like Yuyudhana, Virata, and Drupad. So these were all the allies of the Pandavas. There were also great heroic, powerful fighters like Chekitana. Kaziraj, Purujit, Kunti Bhoja, and Saibya. There are the mighty Yudhyamanyu, the very powerful Uttamauja, the son of Subhadra. Who is the son of Subhadra? Abhimanyu, who is very young, but empowered. He was so powerful. And the sons of Draupadi. All these warriors are Maharathas. Prabhupada translated here as great chariot fighters, but they are so great, they alone could fight with 10,000 other chariots or other warriors. One person. So we think that is this some type of mythology or something? No, but there were people who were so powerful and pious. And with their weapons, they had such powerful, they had gained this by their, they were expert, they were chivalrous, they had their Kshatriya code of honor and duty, and they could wipe out thousands of others single-handedly. This is what the kings were like that previously. If you've ever been to Jaipur, there's a museum, I can't remember what it's called, the Palace Museum or something, and they have one of the older, not even thousands of years old, but a few hundred years old, or even 150 years old or 200 years old. They have one of his coats, and he was like 7 foot tall. And it's huge. Did you see that? Mm. It's huge, and he was huge. He was a fighter, and the first thing he would do, they would do is they'd bathe, then they'd pick up their weapons and practice. That was their sadhana. Fighting, killing, they had to be ready. So if you had a hero like that for your king, because it's natural to want to respect and to have veneration and love for the ruler. If you had a hero like that, not somebody who was the treasurer or something like that, you know, some little guy, some nerd sitting in the back office like that, you know, working on it. No, this is a warrior. And people felt protected when they had a warrior like that who had the spirit, that they would rather fight to the death than see a person in their kingdom disturbed and hurt by someone. They would take that person, and you touch one, someone like, I will kill you. And then the people, no one disturbed the people in the kingdom. That's, you know, the petty thieves, they all ran. There was one, I don't remember where it is, not in the Bhagavatam, but either in the Prana or history, where there was this one, Kshatriya. He had many, many wives, and he went out to battle as king, and then he came, and then his army lost, and they were retreating back into the palace, into the castle for protection, and the army in pursuit. So they came to the gates, and banging on the gates, saying, "Open the gates." And his wives said, "No, I'm your husband. Open the gates." He said, "Our husband would never run from the battle." They wouldn't open it. They were Kshatriyas too. Our husband would rather die than show his back to the enemy. They were heavy people, but people of character. And of course, they tended to be excessive in their behavior because they had, "I am the king." They had to have that sense. They had to have that sense. So they needed balance. The society had balance to it. So to keep them in line, because they the things that they did were so much playing with and tinged with rajagun, the mode of passion, they were, by nature and by culture, they were obedient to the Brahmins. So there are personalities like you, Bhishma, Karna. But for your information, O best of the Brahmins, this is text 7, let me tell you about the captains who are especially qualified to lead my military force. Mama Sanyasi, it's my force. This is our side, or my side. And he's speaking to his teacher like that. So he had that pride too. So he said, Bhavan Bhishmas Chakanas Cha. There is you, Bhavan. There is your good self and Bhishma. So even though Bhishma was a superior warrior, he mentions Dronacharya first, because you have to be careful when you're dealing with who you these little etiquettes, that if you mention the wrong one first and the wrong one second, like that, then this one gets insulted or that one gets insulted. And then you don't want to be insulting your warriors right before the great battle. You want them to be inspired to be with you. So Duryodhana was expert in his diplomacy. There are personalities, Bhavan Bhishmas Chakarnas Cha, like Bhishma, Karna, Kripa, Ashwatthama, and Vikarna, the son of Somadatta. So it is said that Vikarna was one of the, he wasn't on the level of these others warriors. He was one of the other sons of Dhritarashtra. He was one of Duryodhana's brothers. But he was the only one when the attempt was made to disrobe Draupadi, who protested. So he knew he had to flatter him, especially to keep him on his side, because he didn't like the ethics of Duryodhana. So he mentions his name in the midst of the other warriors who are much more powerful and substantial than him, just to make sure that he was going to be on his side. And actually, before the battle began, the rule of the Kshatriyas, they gave anyone a chance to come to the other side. If you want to come to our side, this is your chance. Otherwise, it's to the death. So at that time, Vikarna came over to the Pandava side. So Vikarna and the son of Somadatta, called Bhurisrava, who are always victorious in battle. So that was his hope, because this is his armies he's describing. There are many other heroes who are prepared to lay down their lives for my sake. All of them are well equipped with different kinds of weapons, and they were all experienced in military science. Everyone is going to fight. If I've forgotten anyone, there are others, great warriors as well. Our strength is immeasurable, and we are perfectly protected by Grandfather Bhishma, whereas the strength of the Pandavas, carefully protected by Bhima, is limited. So Bhishma, he's encouraging Bhishma there, because everyone needs their encouragement, their moment from this is right before the battle is going to begin, so he's touching everyone in this way. They have all different weapons. They are experienced. They are unlimited. Bhishma is there. Aparyantam, and aparyantam means immeasurable and insignificant. So Bhima is insignificant compared to Bhishma. Now, all of you must now give full support to Grandfather Bhishma as you stand at your respective strategic points of entrance into the phalanx of the army. So although Bhishma is most important, don't any of you think that your full participation isn't important. So you give your full support to Bhishma, all required. So how did Bhishma respond? Because he was a warrior, very experienced warrior, valiant. So he didn't say anything. As Krishna often would say, heroes don't speak. They show their bravery and power by their actions. So Bhishma's action was to blow his conch shell. He didn't respond. So the conch shell, each conch shell had its own sound, and everyone recognized the conch shell of Bhishma, and it was powerful. Then Bhishma, the great valiant grandsire of the Kuru dynasty, the grandfather of the fighters, that means of both sides, he blew his conch shell very loudly, making a sound like the roar of a lion, giving Duryodhana joy. Someone, when I was in Melbourne, someone told me that they had taken their son to the zoo, and the lion roared while they were there. And even though the lion was in the cage, and I personally have had this experience too, even though the lion is in the cage, when the lion roars, terror enters your heart. They have a shakti. They have a special potency. They are powerful. They represent Krishna. The beast, I am the lion. Not the kangaroo. Powerful. So Bhishma's conch shell is compared to the roaring of a lion. So it had the effect of the roaring of a lion, and people became frightened. People's hearts, at least Duryodhana became joyful when he heard that. Yes, Bhishma, that means he's inspired to fight, because Bhishma and Dronacharya were somewhat partial to the Pandavas. Then, after that, Bhishma's conch shell, then the conch shells, drums, bugles, trumpets, and horns were all suddenly sounded, and the combined sound was tumultuous. So this is a very different kind of battle and war than is fought today. There is heroism. There was actual heroism. And they used to play drums when they were going into battle. And the drums would inspire. Drums affect the heart. And they would play special cadences, drum beats. And they would inspire all the warriors to fight in the battle. And the fighting was done in fields far away from the city. Like Kurukshetra is a big field. And even in, this is how the battles were previously fought. So that the citizens, who were essentially innocent, they weren't harmed. And this whole idea of modern warfare, where they bomb cities and things like that, and so many people killed, it's just very modern. And in the first, they say that the first modern war was in the American Civil War, which is in the, I think, 1870s or something. So that's 19, only 150 years ago that this, what we accept as reality wasn't always reality, the way things were done. But just before 150 years ago, people wouldn't just go and kill all the innocent people. They would, they were warriors. The people, I fight your army fights my army fights yours, and we kill each other. That's the way it goes. But the innocent people,
they, you know, just bomb them and burn down their houses and things like that, and dig and have them dig holes and kill, shoot all the old people, you know, and children. This is Kali Yuga, where and everyone is amazingly completely convinced that we're advancing, and in previous days we're so primitive, and now we're advanced, and before it's primitive. So this is one of the ways that we're advanced, that everyone is terrified because they'll some chemical weapons or atomic weapons or biological weapons or guerrilla warfare, and just the innocent people get killed. And there they would face each other. And the code of the Kshatriya is that if we are fighting with bows and arrows, and then we fight with bows. And if you run out of arrows and you pick up a sword, because you can't, an arrow, a person with a sword can't fight a person with arrows, because you can shoot from so far away, and you can't, with a sword you can't do that. So immediately, if a person ran out of arrows and picked up a sword, the Chacha wouldn't kill him with his arrows. He'd put down his bow, and he would pick up a sword. And what is he saying? That whatever you fight with, I'm better than you, I'm more powerful than you, I don't need this, I will kill you. So there was such a spirit to these people. Now you just, you know, who has the higher technology, they can go in and just boom. And you don't even see who's killing you, who you're fighting with. So Duryodhana was so happy, Bhishma blew his conch shell, and then everyone else and blew their horns and trumpets and bugles and conch shells, and the combined sound was tumultuous. Now, so far, in these first 13 verses, we've just heard what it's like. Excuse me. From the point of view of Duryodhana and that side of the army, now we switch to the other side. On the other side, Tatar Swatar Hayar Yukte Mahati Shandane, this is 14th Stital, Madhava Pandavas Chaiva Madhava and Arjun Divyo Sanko Padadmatu. On the other side, both Lord Krishna and Arjuna stationed on a great chariot that was given to Arjuna by whom? Does anyone know? By Agni, after when the Kandava forest was burned. And then Agni was pleased with Arjuna, and he gave him his chariot. And they were borne by white horses. Krishna and Arjuna surrounded their transcendental Divyo Shanko Pradadmatu. They sounded their Divya conch shells, not just powerful, but divine, transcendental. So Arjuna, as we know, was the warrior, and Krishna, amazingly enough, is acting as his charioteer. Lord Krishna blew his conch shell called Panchajanya in the 45th chapter of the 10th canto, this description of how Krishna got the Panchajanya. And Arjuna blew his, the Devadatta, and Bhim, the voracious eater and performer of Herculean tasks, blew his terrific conch shell called Poundra. King Yudhisthira, the son of Kunti, he blew his conch shell, the Ananta Vijay, and Nakul and Sahadev blew the Sugosh and Manipushpaka. That great archer, the king of Kashi, the great fighter, Sikandi, Dhristadyumna, Virata,
the unconquerable Satyaki, Draupad, the sons of Draupadi, and others, O king, such as the mighty armed son of Subhadra, all blew their respective conch shells. So this is in part of being a king is you have to have allies. So especially in those days, the way that the kings made their allies was intermarrying. And you see this in the history of India, also Europe, actually, but also especially in India, when Aurangzeb and Akbar, Aurangzeb even married Hindu princesses just to make sure that they if another kingdom was tied to them in marriage, whenever there was a battle or something like that, they would be on their side. So this is the way of diplomacy. This is the way of politics. So there were marriages and everyone was related in one way or another, one side against the other. So the blowing of these different conch shells became uproarious. Vibrating both in the sky and on the earth, it shattered the hearts of the sons of Dhritarashtra. So in other words, the conch shells on Duryodhana's side, led by Bhishma, were terrific. But the Pandavas and Krishna's side, their hearts weren't shattered when they heard them. They were powerful, but it didn't shatter their hearts. But when Krishna and Arjuna and the Pandava armies blew their conch shells, the sides on the other side, they became deeply stricken with terror and fear. Now, here's where the the fun begins, but the tension. Of course, you have a battle here, so that's tension. But here's the internal tension, and the issue becomes raised. At that time, Arjuna, the son of Pandu, seated in the chariot, bearing the flag marked with Hanuman, took up his bow, and he prepared to shoot his arrows. The battle was just going to begin. His flag was marked with Hanuman, and Hanuman had agreed to participate. When Bhim was, he met Hanuman when he was going to the high into the Himalayan mountains to take the 1,000-petaled lotus for Draupadi. Hanuman was there, and Hanuman had his tail stretched, and Bhim said, "Move." He was so respectful. He wouldn't step over his tail. You don't step over another living entity. So quite amazing. So he said, "Please move your tail." And he said, "Oh, I'm so old, I can't move my tail. You better move your tail." "Oh, I'm so old, why don't you just move it?" And then Bhim couldn't lift it. So he was so surprised, and he understood it was Hanuman. And then Hanuman benedicted. He said, "I'll participate in the battle, the up and coming battle. I will be the flag. I'll be on the flag." So not just some marking, but he was actually, his potency was accompanying Arjuna on his flag. So everyone had their flags. Why do they have flags? Because everyone had different flags on their chariots. Because if you were on the opposing side and you wanted to kill somebody, you could find them very easily. Everyone had different flags. They were warriors. Because the flag is above everything, so above the din, they could find them. So, and also, Hanuman told Bhim that when you give a war cry, when you shout on the battlefield, my roar will add to your roar to make it even more terrifying. So Arjuna took his bow and he prepared to shoot his arrows. O king, after looking at the sons of Dhritarashtra, drawn in military array, Arjuna then spoke to Krishna the following words. Idam aha mahapate. He spoke to Krishna. And this is what he said. Senayor ubayor madhye. Senayor is the armies, ubayor, both armies, madhye, in between. Ratam stapayame chuta. You take my rat, please, Krishna. You take my rat, my chariot, and drive it in the midst, in between the two armies. He was about to pick up his bow and fire the first arrow, or fire immediately, and start the battle that was about to begin. And instead, he asks something very radical. He says, tells Krishna to drive the chariot in the midst. He wanted to see who he has to fight. So, Senayor, Vyomade Ratam, Stapayame Kruta, Yavare Tan Rikshe Aham, Yudo Kamam. Abastita kar maya sahayodavyam asmin rana samudhyame. So please, O infallible one, O Achyuta, please draw my chariot between the two armies so I may see those present here who desire to fight, with whom I must contend in this great trial of arms. I'll be able to see who's on the other side. So there are many points connected with this. One is that here's practically the first time we see Krishna in action. He's directly being addressed in his situation, even though he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the all-powerful Lord. He's driving the chariot of his devotee. So Krishna has neither shyness nor shame in serving his devotee. Indeed, the devotee conquers Krishna by his love, by the fact that he's a devotee. So that's one point that is just indirectly mentioned here. And another point is the battle is going to begin and Arjuna wants to see. Now's not the time for seeing. Now's the time for fighting. The time for seeing is long gone. Everyone's already blown their conch shells. That means it's just about to begin. And Krishna wants to see, and Arjuna wants to see. Why? What could possibly be on his mind? Please draw my chariot. And going back to the point of Krishna driving the chariot of his devotee Arjuna, and Sri Rangam in Ranga Chitra, Chaitanya Charitamrita describes the illiterate Brahmana whom Mahaprabhu met there, who was reading the Bhagavad Gita every day, but he was illiterate, pronouncing everything wrong and clearly not understanding the words that he was reading. And Mahaprabhu saw him and saw that he was pronouncing everything wrong. And yet tears were coming from his eyes. He was crying. So he asked the illiterate Brahmana what he was doing, why he was reading the Bhagavad Gita, why he was crying, even though he was illiterate. And he said, what can I do? I'm illiterate, but my Guru Maharaj instructed me to read the Bhagavad Gita every day. So I have to do it. So Mahaprabhu appreciated that sentiment, that mood of surrender, and then also said, but you're not just reading it. You're crying as you read it. What is the cause of your tears? You're not understanding the words, the philosophy, but you're crying. It's touching you so greatly. And the Brahmin said, yes, I'm crying. Because even though I can't understand what's being said, in my heart, I see the picture of Krishna driving the chariot of his devotee Arjuna.
And when I think about Krishna serving his devotees, my heart melts and I cry. Now, this is the subject matter, in one sense, of the whole Bhagavatam, to bring us to the understanding of who Krishna is and what is our relationship with him. And then, in one sense, even more so, after we serve Krishna, and we're told that we should serve him with love, but then what's Krishna's relationship with us? That he just has, he's created everyone in such a way that he has everyone serve him. He can't be happy unless everyone in existence is serving him or something. And not only that, if we don't serve him, we suffer so much. And he created it all. So what kind of person is this? And he's a person, he's a supreme person, but is this the kind of person that you want to love? That he creates it in such a way that if you don't do what he wants and love him, and you have to love him, not only serve him, then you suffer. And if you love him, then you can be happy. So that's going to tinge everyone's serving, loving service with complete selfishness. Unless one understands more deeply what's going on. So this Brahmin, who was illiterate, caught the essence of the Bhagavad Gita, the heart of the matter. And the heart of the matter is that Krishna is not a despotic dictator, but rather, because the living entities, their natural position as part of Krishna is to serve him. Krishna is always, and they're naturally blissful, just to be engaged in a natural way in who we actually are causes the happiness for the soul in relationship to Krishna. And then how does Krishna react to these devotees who love him and serve him with such devotion? Is he just happy sitting there on a big throne accepting everyone's worship and hearing all the praise that everyone says about him, and that's what he really likes, all the people praying to him and saying, "You are the greatest, you are the most wonderful, you're all powerful." Is this some kind of lack that he has that feeds him, so to speak? No, and the answer is his pleasure is more that he serves his devotees. That's how he reciprocates with them. He just doesn't sit there and hear. As they love to serve him, he loves to serve them. That is his pleasure. They love to serve him. Why? Because they love him. Because they have an attraction to him. They see his qualities. He's so lovable. And why does Krishna serve his devotees? Because he loves his devotees. This is something that's very, very mysterious. And love of God, love of Krishna, yes, it's so different from fear of God and doing the right thing out of fear, even, or just duty, or because I'm supposed to do it. Krishna consciousness means love for Krishna, wanting to please him out of love, and Krishna reciprocates similarly, wanting to please his devotees out of his love. So it's a genuine and true relationship. So the whole Bhagavad Gita leads us to the doorway of this relationship. And then the Srimad Bhagavatam teaches us in depth this relationship all the way to the point of Vrindavan, which is the summit, the highest point of the reciprocal relationships with the Supreme Personality of God, and the highest point of love for Krishna. So that's the Bhagavatam. So Arjuna asked Krishna to drive the chariot in the midst of the armies, and how does Krishna respond? He doesn't say, "Do you know who I am? You are ordering me to drive the chariot? I am the Supreme Lord." universes come from my skin holes. No. When Arjuna says Sanayar Ubiyamade, Stapayam Rattayam Echita, Rattam Stapayam Echita, Krishna drives a chariot to the, in the midst of the armies. And as Prabhupada explains in his purport, although he's accepted the position of a charioteer for his devotee, his supreme position was not challenged. In all circumstances, this is from Prabhupada's purport, he is the supreme personality of Godhead Rishikesh, the Lord of the total senses. The relationship between the Lord and his servitor is very sweet and transcendental. It is not understandable to the material mind, actually. The servitor is always ready to render service to the Lord, and similarly, the Lord is always seeking an opportunity to render some service to the devotee. He takes greater pleasure in his pure devotee assuming the advantageous position of ordering him than he does in his being the giver of orders. Since he is master, everyone is under his order, and no one is above him to order him. But when he finds that a pure devotee is ordering him, he obtains transcendental pleasure, although he is the infallible master of all circumstances. Such a nice expression. He's the infallible, Ajuta, master of all circumstances. There is no circumstance. Circumstance is a combination of time and place. Because you can be in one place, but at a different time. So it's time and place is a circumstance. And Krishna is the master of every circumstance, of every combination of time and place. So his pleasure again is to serve the devotees. Okay, we should stop here and see if there's any questions or comments. We read 22. Any questions, comments? Before the excitement really begins.
That's an interesting kind of a relationship between being all powerful, like you were talking about in the past, being more powerful and being more merciful, and so you can surrender to this person, and the fact that they can't do anything to help you unless your free will is there.
Yeah.
Like if
it's quite interesting.
A bit weak and a little bit like, I would like to surrender. They still have some aversion to it. They're not all powerful enough to sort of swing it around. Gotta do all the work yourself.
Is that how it is?
Well, sometimes it feels like that.
But he's not all powerful enough. That's not the proper explanation, it seems. It's like, that's not how it works. That's not how Krishna works in relationship to the conditioned soul. That it's not that he's not all powerful enough, but there's the gift of free will to the living entity. So you could say he's not all powerful enough to go against your free will.
Yeah.
But it's not actually the case that he's not all powerful enough. He's given you the free will. So the question of whether can he override your free will?
If you ask him.
If you don't ask him, that was your point. That if you don't ask him and you don't want him to, can he still do it? But you can't put such an imaginary question there. It's more like he has no inclination to. If you don't want him to have a relationship with him, why should he? This is actually described in the 16th chapter, Divine and Demonic Nature, in a comment by one of our acharyas to the Tanaham Dvichita Kroran Samsade Shunarandama verse.
He doesn't have an inclination.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to say that, why doesn't he just take everyone back to Godhead against their will? Because it's against everyone's will. We want to be here, so be here. But when you do want to go back, when we do want to go back, then he facilitates it. Now then the next question is, why does he make it hard? Why doesn't he just make it that all I have to do is say one time, I want to go back, and then I'm back? Why is it hard? Huh? Why does he make it?
I hope I'm not the only one. That's thinking.
Well, you're the only one mentioning it, no. But we're all thinking it. Why is it so hard?
Well, I do think like
but actually, we can't, obviously we can't see it quite from his point of view, from the spiritual point of view. So we've heard Prabhupada say so many times that Mahaprabhu has made it so easy. So we say, why is it so? If it's so easy, how come it seems so hard?
Yeah.
And there's many ways to look at that one, as far as I can see. And one is that as soon as we are serious and one-pointed, then it's not actually hard because we're in Krishna's hands. And then we don't care so much about the externals of this world. If we have a concept that, and this comes out many times, this comes out like in the 11th canto, it comes out like with the Avanti Brahmana. Once we have our mind actually, once it's clear to us and we're surrendered enough and understand enough, this is what I want, and I'm not deviated from that, then really speaking, we are with Krishna immediately. But the problem is, the tendency for a conditioned soul is to really not be sure this is what I want, but rather, yeah, it's sort of what I want if it's true. And not only that, I also have my conditions of other things that I want. So we don't really... Well, not only that, we don't have our mind on it.
Mm-hmm.
So because we don't have our mind on it, we don't get the same result of someone who does have their mind on it. I mean, like Arjuna, he had his mind on learning archery, and he was fixed and focused. And he only saw the eye of the bird, and therefore he got the eye of the bird when he shot.
Yeah.
So if you were thinking, well, there's the eye of the bird, but also there's the feathers, and not only that, there's really nice fruits on that tree, and not only that, my neighbor's tree has mangoes, and these are only apples, and not only that, look at those birds flying in the sky too, and look at the clouds also, and not only that, it's almost time for a dental appointment. So there's, and not only that, I have an itch, and not only that, my computer just crashed, and I haven't downloaded my emails in 3 minutes. Maybe I got an important letter. And not only, and then, so are you going to hit the eye of the bird? No. You're going to be off the mark because the focus isn't there. Yeah.
Same points covered in chapter 12.
Yeah.
That sequence of shlokas, Krishna says, think of me.
Yeah.
And if you can't, then I'll be asked you over practice.
Yeah. Well, and that's actually what we're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
That's the purpose of associating with devotees, and what's supposed to happen in the association of devotees, Satam, Prasankam, none of you talking about Krishna. And we're developing an attraction for Krishna. So there's two things that have to go on simultaneously. One is develop an attraction for Krishna, and one is develop what's the opposite of attraction? Detachment from matter, the world of matter, because you can't just can't keep your foot in both boats at the same time, because you end up in the water, and that's our tendency.
But it seems like while we're in this world, we have to keep our foot in both boats. like you have to go to work, you have to relate with family, you have to run, you have to be able to communicate.
That's the glory of the Bhagavad Gita, because Krishna's got his foot in one, excuse me, Arjuna's got his foot in one boat only, and that's his surrender to Krishna, and yet he's acting in a very, very substantial and tangible and even dangerous situation. So that's why we listen to the Bhagavad Gita, because so we can't say that. So we can't say, well, my situation, how could I do that? Because that's what Arjuna said, I'd rather be spiritual and leave the battlefield. And Krishna said, sorry, I want you to fight. And what he was asking to do is, every time I think about it, you know, in an untheoretical way, it's so heavy. Mm-hmm. He's asking him to kill his family members, his teacher, his grandfather, his guru. And, you know, these are righteous people. And he knew everyone.
And he didn't want to do it.
And he didn't, well, yeah, why should he? I don't want the kingdom that much. I'm not like Duryodhana. Evil-minded, envious, offensive Duryodhana. I'm not like him. So it's an interesting, very pertinent, relevant setting of the scene for philosophy to be spoken. So that we can't say, well, my situation is hard, and Arjuna's was, of course he could do it because he was only had to kill his relatives, but what? I mean.
Also, when you were saying that about Krishna doesn't want to do something, I was thinking how in
Krishna doesn't want to do something?
He doesn't want to save them all. You know, and you say, why can't he just save them all?
That's in the ninth chapter.
If somebody's actually all powerful, and of course we hope that they're all merciful, means that they can be kind, but they obviously have a will and their personality and their own choices and desires. They're not just sort of our servants.
And also, in addition, he does do good for them, because even his neglect is good for them. On the battle of Kurukshetra, everyone who dies in Krishna's presence is liberated. And in this world, he's always saying, come back, in one form or another, come back.
And he's always there, so for someone, no matter what?
Yeah. When he's there, when we're neutral to him, he's neutral to us. Sort of fair in a relationship.
It's a little bit unfair, that means, to sort of just say, why don't you sort of take away all my problems?
Why don't you do everything and I don't have to do anything? So he.
So I can download my email.
Why don't you do everything and I don't have to do anything? But that's the opposite way that we should be, right? Is because instead of telling Krishna what he should do, we should tell ourselves what we should do and let Krishna play his part and we should do our part. So in any relationship, that's what always gets in the way of the relationship, is everyone saying, well, he's like this or she's like that, and he should be doing this or she should be doing that. So it's easy to be thinking what the other person should be doing to satisfy you, as if you were the center. So that type of mentality is sick, actually.
It's not enough to gain the attention of the all-powerful.
Well, would you want to deal with someone like that?
Not very much.
So then we have the concept that, okay, he's all-powerful and all-loving, so he should do what I say, and I can do whatever I want.
Yeah.
He should take care of me regardless of how I act. He should give me everything. Yeah, because what? Why?
The father always takes care of his kids.
That's it.
That doesn't mean he doesn't ground them.
Huh?
That doesn't mean he doesn't ground them.
He says, listen, kid. Listen. I don't know how to say brat in Hindi, but is there a Hindi word for brat? So there's a rascal, something.
Yeah.
the one Prabhupada used to use. You know, if a kid just wants to do that, well, that's what the concept is from, isn't it?
Yeah.
But that's, see, it's the opposite. That's Kali Yuga kid dealing with Kali Yuga father. Because in Kali Yuga, it's like, even in, that's also the last 50 years or something like that. It's the kids can do everything, and the parents' job is to serve the kid. But previously, it wasn't like that. And even, you know, you still get, in India, I mean, not in the cities, but it's not like, it's the opposite. It's like the children are brought up with the idea that, oh, yes, I'm supposed to serve my parents. He's given me so much. She's given me so much. You know, they're all mother lovers and mother worshippers because that's in the consciousness. But this other one is just this Kali Yuga Western way of looking at things, that here I am, just by the virtue of my existence, everyone should do what I want, especially my father. But it's just backwards. I mean, who determines who should take care of who whose duty is it to serve the other? I mean, naturally, the father being responsible, he takes that role to give everything to the son. He wants to, out of love. But if the son is ungrateful and just wants to take advantage of it and doesn't realize or think in terms of his own responsibility, then the father will think, this boy needs to learn something. So I'll teach him by neglecting him. Not that I don't care for him, but neglect is my way of teaching. Yeah. And that's the worst kind of punishment, neglect. Even Varunadeva says that to Krishna. After he says, punish me or forgive me, but do not neglect me. But that's what Krishna does. Samoham savabhuteshu. I'll just be equal. I'll treat you just, I won't give you any deferential treatment because you don't give me any deferential treatment, and you should be, after all. It's not you who's making your heart beat. It's not you who's causing your lungs to breathe and the blood to circulate and causing the food to digest and the causing the air. You're causing the pollution. I'm giving you the clean air, and still, and now you want me to clean it after you. You pollute all the rivers, and then why doesn't he clean it? Why doesn't he make all the living? Well, who do you think you are, anyway? Well, that's the point. Of course, who do we think we are? We think we're God, basically, the center. So this is Kali Yuga. That's how it seems to me, at least when I'm giving class, not when I'm sitting there listening to class. Yeah, it's a perverted mentality, as if we're the center. And I have a right to be served by everyone just because I exist. Well, that's, who do you think you are? Who are you not to give me what I want? And the response is, well, who do you think you are? That I'm supposed to, the Supreme must serve you. He's willing to do it. He's driving Arjuna's chariot. But if we demand, you, without taking our part, this is his greatest pleasure. But if we demand without doing our own duty, then he acts in that way.
Now, I also say that when you have that mentality, which you know with, no matter what you get, no matter what
you're not satisfied.
It does, it's not enough anyway, because it doesn't remove that gnawing dissatisfaction from the heart.
Where is the gnawing dissatisfaction from the heart that's causing for him not doing his part?
Yeah.
Well, usually it's, you know, we can tell what our problem is by seeing what we're figuring that everyone else's problem is. The problem is we're not doing our part. But I think one of our parts is to end on time. And it happens to be on time right now. So if we do that and start on time, then we have something that's workable. So why don't we do that? Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai, Bhagavad Gita ki jai, Sri Krishna Arjuna ki jai. But that mentality that that the Father, his existence is meant for the, it's so deep in the Western psyche. But it wasn't always like that. I remember reading that there was one person who came from Europe. I think it was poet Keats. His father somehow went to the United States from Europe. I think it was him. And he was amazed. He said, in Europe, the children do austerities to please their parents. But in the United States, it's the opposite. The parents do austerities to please the children. It's just upside down. And it's spread. This is the norm. And the children are thinking, if you don't do everything to please me, then... I'll go on the dole and I'll run out. I'll take you to court. Parental divorce. And then the parents, they're also rascals. So it's Kali Yuga. Everyone's crazy, basically. Everyone's unsatisfied and getting worse. What to do? So Mahaprabhu told us what to do. We should chant Hare Krishna, otherwise we're stuck with this with Kali Yuga bodies in with Kali Yuga minds in Kali Yuga, and it's no fun. Okay, so we'll try again tomorrow. Continue the great dilemma of Arjuna.